I think what the MW gives you is, and when I was in the depth of it, oh my God, you know, you become so acute about wine. You pick things like bang, bang, bang all the time. It also destroys your love of wine for at least 6 months afterwards. It's exhausting. Mm. And you really don't want to have to do that. So you drink beer for 6 months later.
Welcome to the Hospitality Podcast.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Come on, man.
I just need a...
This lamb
Where's the lamb sauce?
Presented by Arthur Gomez.
God damn, I just spent $8,000 on some f***ing wine.
And Quentin Wind.
What are you?
An idiot sandwich.
So pour yourself a glass, because we're diving into the world of restaurants, kitchen and bar. The Hospitality Podcast.
Hey, welcome back, guys.
Hello, hello.
We're back again with a new guest.
Victoria, welcome to Breaking the Cork. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you very for exciting. The invitation.
Yeah,
your first one as well.
It is my very first.
First podcast with us. What a pleasure. Now, thank you very much today for joining us. So, as we talked about before the podcast, during the next 40 minutes, we're going to talk a bit about your background, all your adventure. You had a lot of experience in London.
Try and fit that in 40 minutes, I'm not sure.
We can do an hour, it's okay. Fine. We're going to try to go deep down in your different experience when you used to work for St. John's, when you had your wine bars as well, and also your current position now at Rowe, when you're working with Fallow as well.
Yeah, I'm the group head of wine. For the business.
Great. So. Before, we're just going to introduce the wine. We open actually a bottle of red wine right now. Quentin, do you know this wine?
Nope.
I'm asking you the tricky question because I bring the bottle. I think I saw the bottle, but Quentin.
So, yeah, of course I know it by heart. Come on. It's a 2001 Croisière Hermitage. Lemonnier. I'm sure you guys have heard of it. But, it's, what do you think about it? What's your take?
It's a good choice for tonight. It's quite minerally on the nose.
It is.
It's not a fruit bomb.
No.
But I thought, yeah, there's that slightly sort of Syrah character. There's that nice smokiness. I remember I'd always be tasting wine blind. And every time I'm like, oh, I hate that. I'm like, oh, it's Shiraz. There's normally Australian Shiraz versus, say, a Syrah. But there's a real character that I often find. But
do you like about all this wine from the Rhône, North Rhône, with like a bit of character, spice?
Just not too much oak.
Yeah, okay.
I think I'm allergic to too much oak.
Okay.
So not literally, figuratively. Yeah. I just find it so... When it overpowers the wine, if you've got beautiful fruit, why cover it with oak?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So Bordeaux, you're not too fan?
Oh, no, I love Bordeaux.
Okay. Not too oaky.
Well, I used to blend the claret for St. John.
Yep.
Nice.
And I made sure that had no oak in it at all. So it was all in concrete.
Okay.
So I wanted that real sort of blue graphite-y fruit character. Yeah. So it's really fresh, so you can just keep on drinking it. So in that classic old school claret style. That's not them. I'm totally contradicting myself when I say that. It's an easy drinking red.
Exactly.
Versus a high end. But those with age are fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's a nice bottle. It's just basically so Chapoutier, I say Quentin, perfectly. it's a Croisière Hermitage from Chapoutier, so from the north of the Rhône Valley. I think, as you say, it's a 2021 vintage. It's quite bold, it's quite spicy. It's actually, as you say, Victoria, really perfect for the, for the weather.
Smooth. It's beautifully smooth. It'll take food happily.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But on its own. Great.
It's very great. And it's not a partnership or anything. we bought this bottle at Majestic Wine. We paid for it. So basically, Victoria, just to come back on your...
Tell me, Arthur.
So you were talking just before about the blend you did at St. John's.
Yeah.
Can you explain a bit more about your experience at St. John's? What was your role? What time did you work there? For how many times?
I moved back from Australia for the role.
Okay.
So previously, I'd had my own businesses. And so I came back as their head of wine. And part of that involved doing all of their blending of their pig label wines. So at the time, there was claret. We introduced two Mâcon Village and Mâcon.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And they already had Bourgogne. We had the Cremant, Bordeaux Blanc. I said that already. A little of the Beausoleil Rosé.
Okay.
So yeah, those the range has expanded since I left.
Yeah,
but that's what I was doing.
Also, he's very focused. Well, St. John's is very focused on wine, or developing more and more wine, or they have a kind of.
It's really interesting because what Trevor did when he started, he always would talk about being a vitrine or a shop window for wines, and so it would never be exclusive. So it was always about sharing wines, and if someone wanted to bring them in, great, go for it. But it was really about, you know, he's got an extraordinary 20 plus years, okay, we came up to 30 years now, of experience in a network. Mm-hmm. And so every year had gone by. So I'd go with him. And when I was there for, was that 3-4 years?
Yep.
COVID put an end to that.
4 years. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So we're always looking for new wineries and seeing sort of old friends. And the blending was some of my favorite things to do.
And so basically, just to explain to our listeners, when you say you were blending wine, meaning that you were looking for like vineyards around France or...
So, no, what we'd do is we'd work with particularly producers and I'd give a brief and I'd say, right, I'm looking for, you'd agree a certain quantity, which was our own blend. Mm. And then originally I'd go down there and would taste through, work, say, 4 or 5 tanks, depending on what the wine was, the Sauvignon, Semillon, the Bordeaux Blanc, that came, I think, from memory from 3 sites. So we'd either have different tanks to play with, and then you taste them all, and each one, none of them were right on their own. So it was always about bringing the combination. And sometimes, you know, I may have 5 tanks to work with, but I may just use 3 of those tanks in different ratios.
So it
really is. It's literally like,
literally blinding to find the perfect.
5%. Sort of, I'd be there and I'd taste and go, okay, that's gonna be really good for the mid palate. This will work better at the back, but we need something at the front. And so it was always about bringing it together into it was a jigsaw puzzle.
Nice.
Yeah.
So St. John's, when you started working for them, what was your job title? Is it like you had to develop the wine?
So my title was head of wine.
Okay.
So. Yeah, so I was in charge of their wine business.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you working on the floor as well?
No. So the one thing about St. John is there are no sommeliers. As much as I love working on the floor, that's not what I really am. I mean, I work as one sometimes and I love it. But for me, it's always been about sourcing the wine, finding the right wines to match and training people about it as well.
Behind the scene.
Yeah.
Nice.
And behind the scenes are good. We like out front too. We like both. I can't decide.
Mix of both is good.
And so basically all the wine, because so I've been to St. John's recently, and from like, if I was not in the wine industry, from like, you know, general public perspective, you can think sometimes when you see the bottle of St. John's that it's the property of St. John's or the producer, that they are their own producer and they have a St. John's estate, you know. But basically, that's not it. They're buying the juices.
So so there are different ways, and this will be, I don't know what's happened since I left, but there are different ways of having your own label. One, you can talk to a winery and just literally slap a label on.
White labeling, basically.
Exactly. Or you can, depending on the sort of quantities, you know, if it's 6,000 bottles or 12,000 bottles, then you can start to blend. That's where the fun begins.
Okay.
And so then that becomes an exclusive blend, which will then be bottled for us.
Okay.
But St. John also does have a winery down in the Languedoc. The Boulevard Napoleon.
Okay, nice. Okay, great.
Which is in Minervois.
So they
have vineyards there.
I know Minervois very well.
Do you?
Yeah, my girlfriend's dad has vineyards in Minervois.
Okay.
Oh, really?
He's very... Oh, God.
Didn't know about that.
Yeah, they're amazing. Some really old bush vines.
It's one, actually, for the for the fact, is it's one of the regions where it's the cheapest to buy any wine parcels, basically.
Good value.
Very good value,
We like to say good value.
Yeah. Very good point. Very good.
But also the material is amazing.
Yeah.
I was trying some wine the other week and it was coming out of Roussillon. And you got, you know, 80-100-year-old vines.
Yeah.
And the quality of the grapes is extraordinary. And the wine that you can produce and the value is second.
The value is the probably one of the, I was going to say like the best in the world. Not sure about it. But in France, probably one is the best. Yeah. Because now if you look at all the famous ones like Bordeaux, Burgundy, Bavarian, Jura, Savoie, delicious. I love it. But damn, you need need the bank account for it.
Yeah.
And also too, because when you've got still for now with climate change.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are more and more problems. Mm. And Burgundy's just had the most terrible vintage for a very long time.
Yeah.
Mm. So, yeah, France has limitations. So Roussillon is still really good value. But then I was in Greece last year, and there's some amazing wines in central Greece. And you can still get really good value.
And consumption as well. Like, for example, Bordeaux now, where they got like this massive stock of wine, and nobody's really buying that much Bordeaux. So now the production is like huge, and the consumer now like a bit, you know, a bit angry with Bordeaux. And so now it's kind of a tricky. And Burgundy, they don't have enough stock. It's all about, but when you're going to the Languedoc de Roussillon, they got the stock, they got great wine, and they got the value. So much wine you can get for under 20 quid, which is amazing.
I think there's some really interesting wines that sit in that landed price, so trade prices of 15 to 18, so it's a higher end.
Yeah.
But it's still cheaper than, say, Chablis.
Of course.
And some of those wines are exceptional.
Yeah. So how's your wine list at Fallow? We're going to go back after with your answer.
So I haven't done anything on Fallow's list. I was brought in to start Row.
A few months ago, right?
End of March.
Okay, yeah. Great.
So we Row opened in April. And so I was brought in and created the wine list. We had my SOM team, so the three of us, and had about 400 samples.
Mm.
And I said, right, we need to do this within a week. So we did about, they nearly killed me, 5 days of like bang. And we just did region, style, and it was really interesting because the three of us were able to come up with a really well-balanced list across suppliers. We're using about 10 suppliers.
Yeah.
I think diversity is really important on a wine list. I don't like to see a list that is just three or four.
Yeah.
And I think we've got about 120 wines, plus the fine wines as well. So it's a list of two parts.
Okay, nice. Yeah. And so in terms of fine wine, because I know in terms of foods, they have like the rooftop where they have their own like a small garden they use for the kitchen at Row.
Yes.
So in terms of fine wine, do you have like a special space for the wine?
Or is a bit of a special space.
Yeah.
When you walk through the door, there are these amazing two glass, I call them glass houses.
Okay.
Which are our sort of wine cellars, temperature controlled.
Yeah.
And a lot of the fine wine is in there, and then some Eurocave.
Okay.
So yeah, James put together a very, they've got a great list that's come across from Fallow on the fine wine. But I really just focused on the more everyday drinking.
Mm.
So you know, the fine wines are lots of fun.
Yeah.
And they're, again, well-priced. We're not looking at normal margins because I think we want people to drink the wines. We don't want it just sitting there. And then the rest of the wines also, I did it in a different style. I like to see a wine list in style. If you think about a menu when you're going to look to, when you want food, you're always thinking, like, what do I feel like? What am I in the mood for? And I think that really works well with wine as well.
Mm.
So I don't want to feel like something like fresh and crisp or something a bit heavy and peppery and spicy. You know, what do I feel like right now?
Yeah.
And particularly too with rose food, it's not straightforward. There's a lot of different flavors. There's lots of spice. So you need to find wines that are really what I call shapeshifters.
Mm.
So they sort of can, bend and meld and happily take on the different flavors because there's quite a lot of spice in some of this.
Oh, that's good. So that's mean you, when you're thinking about your wine list, you're not thinking about, okay, I'm going to do Spain, Italy, and you're going to do like, okay, this is going to be like light body, medium body, full body.
Yeah.
That's good.
I've got slightly different names and what I did. I did that when I had my bar as well.
Okay.
And I think it's something that is done a lot more in Melbourne than it is in London.
Mm. Yeah.
But I've had really good response. It means people can learn at the same time.
Mm.
I think there's nothing that I hate more than getting this huge tome of a wine list. One, it means I don't talk to my friends. I'm like, I'll see you in half an hour. Scrolling through, trying to see.
I know what you mean.
But then you've got no idea what these wines are.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it suddenly becomes so up itself.
Yeah.
And I just think wine should be enjoyed, and it's hard enough for people to drink wine. They get scared. And whether it's pronouncing the variety, the region, France is great for confusing the hell out of everyone. My first memory of moving to London a long time ago was, I remember I was in Waitrose. I saw these bottles saying claret. I'm like, what the hell is claret? it's Bordeaux. Okay. Also, it's Cabernet and Merlot. And so it's a red blend. I know, it's like, it's such an English thing.
Mm.
And then you go, so Burgundy. So there's, so that's Chardonnay. So unless you know some of the rules, you're excluding people straight away.
So much.
So for me, it's much more fun to say, hey, do you want something, big and buttery? Okay, so that could be a Chardonnay.
Mm.
I won't be a Chablis. unlikely, but that is still the same grape, you know. Mm-hmm. There'd be so many stories of people saying, I hate Chardonnay, but I love Chablis, and vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the the most common thing. Is like, yeah, it's the classic. The classic one.
Yeah. So for me, it's really important to make wine accessible.
Yeah.
And I hate saying demystifying, but I think you can find some really interesting wines that people wouldn't normally go to. And even without a sommelier, and as I said, I don't call myself a somm or a sommelier, because for me, I do so much else. You know, I judge, I write, I blend, I buy, I do it all.
You sell.
I sell.
Used to.
I used to sell, used to import. I do all of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's, I just think it's nice to keep one as accessible as possible.
Yeah.
So if we come back to your roots, obviously you're from Australia.
I am.
Melbourne.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful city. Great goon.
Great what?
So did you say great goon?
Great goon?
Yeah, goon.
Oh, you've got to play, what's it called? You need a hills hoist.
Okay.
And a goon bag.
And a goon bag.
Also known as bag in box here, or cask. Uh-huh. You just peg it onto the clothesline and spin it round. And when it stops at you, you then just...
jog it.
Yeah, interesting.
The classy.
But is the cheapest, if you can call it wine, how do they make goon? Because it's a big question around so many English people, but also international people that travel to Australia, just like me. We never knew. We've had loads of people saying, oh yeah, there's like fish eggs in there, there's this, that. Yeah, it's disgusting. You get the biggest headaches.
It's got a little bit of kangaroo tail in there as well.
Yeah.
Because everything will try and kill you in Australia anyway. So we'll try and do it in a box.
We need to know
Do I need to demystify this for you?
Yeah. I think it'll be good for
everybody who will listen to the podcast.
To give the real reality of what goon is.
So goon or cask wine, you know, the cooler bar, you'd always have a box of cooler bar in the fridge. And they used to be like 2 litres or 4 litres. So fridge is bigger in Australia. I think our houses are bigger. But this segues back to St. John, because St. John has their own bag-in-box, which I used to also was involved with blending.
Nice. Mm.
So we made wine that was delicious. And people think goon, bag-in-box, is always cheap. Traditionally, it has been. But it has a perfect seal. So you actually keep your wine fresher for longer.
Yeah.
But my God, all the stories of, you know, you go to people's houses and there'd be a box of wine sitting on top of the fridge, nice and warm. But it was easy. Come around for a glass of wine. Mm. They'd get the little, you know, cheese cubes out, a little bit of Cabana.
Easy, cheaper. And now you get some really good ones.
You get some really good ones. You still get some really rubbish ones.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're making it the same way as you make wine.
Yeah.
You're just... it's a different bottling process.
Yeah.
You know, but let's not confuse something called British wine, which is not wine at all, which is coming from grape must. So it's actually not made from pure grapes and picked the traditional way. That's for another time, though.
So, yeah, goon doesn't have fish eggs. You can confirm that.
There are as far as I'm aware, I haven't come across any fish eggs in any goon. They may find the wine using like fish product.
Yeah.
But no, there are no fish eggs.
There you go, guys.
No redbacks, no kangaroo tail.
Yes.
But it could probably work really well with the kangaroo tail stew.
And no brown snake inside as well. There you go.
Don't think it's any of that.
Good.
So yeah.
So yeah, you were born in Melbourne, and until what age did you live in Melbourne?
A lady never reveals her age, Quentin.
Oh, I never asked your age.
But let's just say I moved here at the turn of the century.
Okay.
2000.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
So I moved here, and I came here originally for a 2-week holiday and stayed for 7 years.
No way. Mm. So long holidays.
Yeah. So I'll try and keep this quick. I moved here having worked. I was studying. I joke it drove me to drink.
Yeah.
So I was a scientist. Definitely drove me to drink. And I moved to London and thought I was going to continue studying here. But all my experience was the wrong kind. And I remember walking into a wine shop. I'd gone into Majestic. These are the days where Odd Bins and thinking, I'll join one of their programs and see. And I walked into a shop on Northcote Road and walked in and went, I recognise all of those wines. They're all Australian. And I don't know any of those which were mainly Italian. And it's a couple, Karen and Mike Rogers, who own Phil Glass and Swigert.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my wine career in the UK. And nice. I said, I know these wines. I said, do you want to come and help us out one weekend? I said, sure. And that was the beginning of, you know, what became amazing. a 20-plus year career now.
So the wine passion, where did it come from?
I don't know. I think I remember the day that I realized I was interested in wine. And I was at uni and I'd bought a bottle. It was Trentham Estate Merlot. And it was great. And then one day went and bought another bottle and it tasted different. I'm like, it's another vintage. Oh my God. I said, do you have any of this other vintage? Because I need this one because the new one is awful. And it was just shit. And I was like, what can... And so they're ringing around for me and I bought all the last of that vintage. And I think that's when I realised, like, hold on, this is really interesting.
It has a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and it was definitely one of those fun memories. Dad was very much, you know, Vic, you need to know what wine is. And I was drinking it, tasting wine, you know, at the table, probably very French style.
Yeah. Know,
with a bite to eat, often sometimes out of a cask.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no. So as in cask wine, than... not a...
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a barrel when I say cask.
Yeah. So bigger than the... Yeah, bigger than a goon bag, basically, a cask.
No, goon bag.
So we call it cask wine. Okay. Oh, you call it cask wine. Okay.
Cask.
But you know what? Talking about early on when you said, you know, it's always nice to have a, you know, cask, obviously a cask wine bag, goon. Box, wine box, something. However you call it, yeah. At home. For me, whenever I go to see my grandparents, I know there's always one red, one white, one rosé. I mean, it's, I don't know, I grew up with the wine bags. I don't know, yeah. On your side, if
same.
That's... Same. Yeah? Yeah.
So, I mean, not like on an everyday basis, but like, for example, like barbecue, or when we used to have like a family party or something. Yeah, you see the bag and box. Yeah. With the
and it's only in England that has not yet been... adapted to it. I mean,
I think
it's hard. I don't know.
I remember there was a piece written when I was at St. John, and because they were doing 10-litre for trade,
yeah,
and for their bar and the restaurant, and then we did 3-litre. Was it 3-litre? I think takeaway
3 to 5.
Yeah.
And we did threes. Two, more than two. Anyway, and I remember looking at some of the wines. Yeah, there's a lot of rubbish out there. Yeah. But because it wasn't, it's never been considered as a serious option.
Yeah.
But when you think about how you're being more sensitive to the use of bottles and carbon footprint and just the cost, bag-in-box suddenly becomes quite a compelling offer. And it, as long as you've got... It's really easy for red wine because you can store it anywhere. White, you've got to have a big enough fridge.
That's the thing.
Or a window you can keep it outside when it's cold because if you're in London, it's always cold.
Yeah. So.
But also, don't you think it's because of the packaging? Because I feel like now, especially now with, you know, all this natural wine, biodynamic wine we have with like the nice funky label, now we tend to have more and more people buying the bottle because of the label, not because of the wine.
I'm sure you can do funky boxes. So,
of course, no, but now they are, for example.
Oh, there are.
Okay. Yeah, there's few. But the thing is, like, nobody's going to see the bag in box anyway. You know what I mean? It's not supposed to be on the shelf or anything. Except if it's for retail.
Come over for my dinner party. Here is my beautiful bag in box.
At the restaurant.
There are some very cool containers that you can actually put them in.
I'm surprised there isn't like a restaurant that... Oh, I mean, a wine bar where actually... That wine bar chooses, makes a selection of, I don't know, maybe 30,
only bag in box.
Don't
give some business idea like this.
But imagine like 30 boxes just stacked one on top, and then people can literally go and help themselves on a membership kind of basis. I don't know.
It's a little bit like wine on tap.
Exactly. Yeah. But exactly. I feel like wine on tap is a bit like, oh, it's in the keg, it's behind. Whereas there, you know,
also it can be a little bit too natural in that sort of dirty way.
I see what you mean, yeah.
What do you think of the one on tap?
I'm yet to find one that I really like. The ones I've had, I've seen faults in them.
Yeah.
I've been judging for a long time. So for me, does my face now match the colour of the wine? I think it probably does.
No. Oh my
God. I've totally lost my thought. What was I saying?
On tap.
Thank you. Yeah. I haven't found one. And I don't know if it's a sulfur regime. I haven't found one I like.
Okay.
Okay.
There's a challenge.
Guys, there's a challenge outside for you. If you can make a good one on tap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just send it to Victoria and she's going to judge you very badly.
Perfect. So, Melbourne, you obviously started to love wine because you realized how from one year to another it's completely different. Your dad obviously a bit of help behind, well, not help, but
I guess he didn't discourage me.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, I actually, my very formative years in the wine trade was when I was still studying back in Melbourne at a place called the, oh my God, why have I just, that's really embarrassing.
Oh, we want to hear it.
No,
perfect.
And pause, regroup, the Melbourne Supper Club. So the Melbourne Supper Club opened in 98, 99, and it was a door.
Okay.
And you didn't know, it was table service only. You had to find the door, and it was upstairs.
Okay.
And it actually is an amazing, there's this huge round window, and it looks straight out onto Parliament House. That is where I really, you know, the team there, what Con and Josh did, and they're still going now. I mean, I caught up with Con a few months ago on a, who's doing a bit of a recce for his next restaurant here.
Okay, nice.
And I think, you know, what they did, because it's all table service, but it was all sofas, so it was really comfy. And that's when you could smoke cigars indoors. And we were open till 4 a.m. or 6 a.m. So it was this, it was crazy, but so much fun, and would have wine tastings every week. So you'd always be learning, always be tasting. And yeah, I think that's where I really thought, hang on a moment.
Sounds like the perfect place. You have wine tasting, you can smoke cigars, stable service, but you will sit on the couch. If the food is great and the wine list is great,
food was small. It was just light little bits.
Okay.
It was great.
Even better.
Yeah. It was a supper club, you know, so.
Yeah. So you moved to London.
Yes. It's a long story, isn't it? Yeah. And it happened
It's your story.
Yeah. It is my story. It's a long story. It's really
It's all about you.
It's all about me. Oh, my God. Stop it. I'm an only child. I'm not used to this.
But so your first job in wine was in Australia?
Yeah. That was my part-time. That was at the Melbourne Supper Club.
Yeah. Okay.
And then when I moved here, I sort of fell into the role at Phil Glass and Swigert.
Mm.
And then after that, fast forward a bit, I'd go to a lot of tastings, and then I was invited to judge at the International Wine Challenge.
You're still a judge?
I am. I'm a panel chair.
So how did you become a judge?
I think in those heady days where it was less cool, they asked me. When I finished at Phil Glass, then I went and worked at Bibendum, and I did all their PR and trade marketing, as in not the restaurant, but the wine company.
The wine company, okay.
Formerly known as Bibendum, which I don't know, it's different, very different beast now. It was only about 100 staff when I joined.
Really? Now it's massive, right?
It's huge. Yeah. It's huge, yeah. So when I left there, I set up my own importing business. Yeah, I was here for about 7 years. I have a 7-year itch. It's already 7 years now, so... I'm still staying, it's okay. But so I saw an opportunity and started importing wine.
So buying wine and then selling the wine to like to the consumer or to the trade?
To the trade.
To the trade.
So I saw an opportunity. Bibendum was really interesting. These were the really heady days. You know, it was Bibendum, Liberty and Anotria. They were the top three.
The three mastodon
importers who had a great range, who were really forward thinking, who were doing things that no one else had. This is before joint ventures really happened, and they had really exciting portfolios.
And that's where you met Arno.
I met Arno when my importing business. So Bibendum, I met Arno through a mutual friend. In the trade, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I left Bibendum, I saw an opportunity. I thought, you know, there are all these small producers who fall through the cracks. And I seemed to have no fear. So I went home and went, okay, Victorian wine. And so I just found a few of my favorite producers and said, I want to bring your wines to the UK.
Amazing.
So I did.
How was it back in the time, more is even now, I suppose?
Oh. How was it as in...
As in importing the wine in
UK. God, it's like what everyone is now learning about with Europe.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a pain in the bum. To get anything out of Australia has to say, yes, your wine is good enough to be exported.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. There's a wet tax, which is a wine equalization tax of about 29%.
From Australia.
So they add on. So what if I remember correctly, if you're a small producer and you want to export your wine... you can't claim that 29%. So if you keep it in Australia, it's sort of protectionism.
Mm-hmm.
who would do that? And so it was not exactly the most encouraging environment to bring wine across here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a unknown, you know. I was bringing in, people said, Victorian wine, is that like from an era? I'm like, no, it's from a state in Australia. Think Melbourne and, oh, you know, it was, you know, like I said, I have to giggle. But, I mean, I still remember, I mean, God, I've so many. I had Paul Henry used to head up Wine Australia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just spoke to Paul. I said, look, I want to bring these guys in. We're all tiny and they can't afford to each have a membership. So we put everything under one. And I had six wineries, all Victorian, all cool climate, all a bit interesting and different. And I remember having, I was at the tasting and Stephen Spurrier was there and he came to the table. I'm like, okay, this will be interesting. And handed him a rosé from Ballarat, made from Pinot Noir. And he went, this is exactly what a Pinot Noir rosé should be. This is very good. I'm like, hell yeah. Okay, this is good. And so it was really, it was just one of those moments where you go, okay, I've got this. It's something which was ahead of its time. But then I had quite a lot of, I had people here getting behind me who were fantastic. Who really encouraged me not to be dissuaded, but people were keen and they're like, oh, this is new and different. And it's a bit of that. At that time, that's when people would tend to have one supplier would take half a wine list and maybe be just working with two. So it was a way to fill out a list to not fatten up, but give it some interest.
Mm.
So, yeah.
It's now it's so different. I feel like now a restaurant, we have like, well, Quentin, for example, you have a wine bar,
mm-hmm.
right, on Belmont Street. How many suppliers do you have?
I think we got about five now.
Five, six,
yeah. Six
for
maximum.
A small wine shop and bars.
Yeah. The problem nowadays, so, like, it's the minimum order.
Yeah.
And it keeps going up. Yeah.
Like, yeah, well.
And
yeah.
Especially since they put the tax, Brexit, and they put the tax.
Now, yeah.
Obviously, they're trying
to... But the duty is going to change things again. Mm. I guess it depends. I mean, when I have my bar here, that was a 70-seater, and I had a little wine shop with it as well, different stock. So it's just about being clever with your stock and making sure. But, yeah, you can't just send me a case. You've got to think it through a bit more.
It's a bit of a shame because...
Talking about your bars, Swain's, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about
Swain's Wine Bar and Store. That came out as my role at St. John was made redundant, and that was COVID. And I was like, shit. What am I going to do? And I think all my life, everyone said, you got to start making wine. You know, why don't you get a vineyard? I'm like, are you absolutely insane?
Mm.
Ain't no way would I want to be married to a vineyard because then I have to drink that wine for the rest of my life.
That's the thing. And I feel like everybody, when you work in wine, they're like, oh, so your goal is to have a vineyard. But I guess like maybe 10% of people from the industry want to have a vineyard.
It's really romantic.
It's very romantic, but it's so difficult to sustain.
For me, I walk through the vineyards. I would much rather consult and help people blend wine and make wine and do something interesting there.
Yeah.
That's far more fun.
Yeah.
And to see what's going on in different vineyards. And otherwise you get cellar palate. It's hard for me to say. And then you get so constrained with what you're drinking all the time that you can't see beyond. And for me, it's always about diversity.
Drinking the same wine every day. And because it's your wine, you're like, oh, yeah, it's good, it's good. And you're always saying to people, did you try my wine?
Yeah. Well, I see with my godfather in a way, it's kind of that.
You can get super critical.
Yeah.
And then I know even when I'm blending wine, you're sitting there thinking, shit, this is really important. I can't put this up.
Yeah.
I really like this. I think others will too. But it's really nerve-wracking. And then they do the blend and they send in the sample and you're going, I like it. Or you're like, oh, God, thank God. You know, and then it's like, okay, it's fine. But you always have that self-doubt. Well, I know I do. So, yeah. But no vineyard, no wine.
No vineyards. But a wine bar.
The bar. The bar was Melbourne inspired.
Okay.
What about a chateau with vineyards in France? Sounds good, no?
Oh, sounds great.
But just the chateau, not the vine. You're just selling the juice to like a big cooperative.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you make £1 million, euros in the wine trade? Start with 2 million.
Yeah. That's true.
So the wine bar was a bit of a dream which came about. It was definitely Melbourne inspired. It was something that I think I've just taken 20 years of tasting wines, friends, wineries, wine bars, restaurants. And God, I missed home. So I created a mini home for me. It was purely selfish.
Not really.
I mean, it was a huge bar to sit around.
I saw the pictures. It looks great.
It was a
huge wine bar, very nice, with the big center or the bar in the center.
Yeah, big horseshoe. It was nice. You know, there's loads of wine bars with charcuterie. That's fine, but I like to have proper food, and I think that's something that Melbourne does really well. We have a lot of wine bars, and when I was importing wine to Melbourne, there'd always be restaurants and different bars, and they would always have what I call proper food. You know, we had proper wine, proper food. Simple. Because cheese and charcuterie only goes so far. So sorry for everyone who has a wine bar that just does cheese and charcuterie. But for me, I want something a bit more substantial.
Yeah. But that's the trend nowadays at the moment is, you know, wine bars with little plates.
Little plates.
I love those.
A dirty word, little plates.
Sharing plates.
Yeah, but in terms of cost, you know, when you want to have like a sharing plate, as we say, which now is the trend, because everybody wants sharing plates. I love sharing plates. So. But you need a kitchen, you need a chef, you need a chef.
Yeah.
It's costly. It's very costly.
It is. I mean, the taxman takes more money than anyone else.
And only that, like on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, those 3 days where you're not going to be making any money. Because you don't have, not everyone drinks on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But when it comes to Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and that's where you need to make your money. Yeah. And then Sunday, it's a hard one as well.
Weekend is your bread and butter.
Sunday, not really, but Friday, Saturday.
It depends who you are as well. So Sundays can be huge. I was right by the heath. That worked well.
That's true.
Good weather. You know. But even to this day now that's gone, people will see me in the street. They go, oh, my God, Vic, please tell me that there's a good wine bar nearby. Where do we go? What are you doing? Please open another.
So what's the reason it's gone now?
Let's just post-COVID.
Yeah.
It was 3 years, 2 years and a half?
Just over 2 years. I had a very... Shall we say a narrow-minded landlord?
It's always a landlord issue.
Really understand commercial or restaurants.
Okay.
So no matter what I did, they were like, nah. And I'm like, okay. And I mean, the space is probably a little bit too big. I had some bad advice, but the concept worked.
Okay.
So it was not
like a financial issue.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Well, it was turnover, and you know, pay my rent late.
Landlords
don't like that, but most you can negotiate, and they were just not having a bar of it. Even though the rest of the street was like, "Oh my God, we need you." Okay. So you sort of live and learn, and what didn't kill me.
Yeah, no, of course, but it's always there's always sticks in you know that goes in the wheel. Is that an expression in English?
No, that's
a French one then.
I think it is.
But there's always issues and. I've never had one shop where I didn't have any issue with the landlord. For some reason.
Everyone I speak to, it's all the same. Unless you can own the building.
Yeah.
100%. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. Because McDonald's.
Everywhere. I mean, I mean, there's places like, you know, Fredericks in Islington. They own that building. They were able to get through COVID easily.
Easy, yeah.
That's right.
And, you know, there'll be places in Soho, if they're early on and you're able to buy something.
Yeah.
God, they're so lucky. That's true. Is an absolute blessing.
Just to rent is very difficult to find the venue, because sometimes when it's your first business or just your second, it's so difficult because you got all this, like, you know, company who have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 one bar. Obviously, the landlord's going to be, well, you get a background, you got some financial, you know, like behind you. So obviously, they're going to go with them. So I don't know. I feel like now it's so difficult if you want to open like a business right now, or was like a Bermondsey corner when you opened it?
Well, for us it was relatively easy, but that's because we were very lucky. When we got the lease, it was a family friend that had the lease of that shop, and I've always told her, hey, the day she wants to move, because she always talked about moving to a different country, I was like, let me know, I'll be very interested to take over the lease. And COVID hit, and she decided that was the moment to move to Spain. So when I knew about it, I went straight to her and said, can we do this quiet, silently, that no one kind of knows about it, that it doesn't go on the market, and that's how we got the lease of that one. And luckily, because it was during COVID, the landlord she was due a rent review. Mm-hmm. Because it was 5 years, and the landlord, she was like, you know what, because it's COVID, we, you know, I'll give it another 5 years without putting the rent up.
That's great.
So one way, she didn't need to cut the cut her rent because of review, but she managed to get another tenant with the same rent for her. So it was like a win-win situation for everyone.
She's really lucky. Yeah. As were you. You know, that's.
And
if only it could all happen like that.
Yeah. But when we took the funny thing is, when we took over the lease, we had no clue what we were going to put in that shop. So we had zero clue.
Okay.
And because I was working in a bakery with Jean-Michel, a friend of mine, we were meeting every local people because everyone had nothing to do at home apart from going to their local bakery / cafe.
Yeah.
So every customer, we're like, oh, what would you add to the street?
Nice. Well, you know, nice.
And it came up to like, okay, there's no wine, there's no cheese, there's no variety of stuff. So we're like, you know what, let's adapt a shop for COVID rules, which was a wine shop.
Retail.
And then, retail with cheese and, you know, little aperitif stuff.
Yeah.
Pate, whatever. And then later on, when we're allowed to get people inside and sit down, then we kind of adapt it to a wine bar / retail bar. Retail wine. And other stuff.
Did you have the wine off the shelf that you then have inside, or was it? How did you do the wine component?
What do you mean by that?
So, because there's a current model where, you know, wine's on the wall.
Yeah.
And you drink it in, or you take it away.
Oh, so yeah, we have a menu, but the menu is that we have one glass of wine per color.
Mm-hmm.
That we choose and we change depending on the availability, but it's pretty much every 2 days that we change. And then we got a special that we change as well. So actually there's two by the glass of each, red, orange, white.
And then you can choose the bottle on then, the shelf.
Yeah, you choose the bottle by the shelf, and I think we're at £12 corkage fee. It works really well. It's funny, at first... It's, you know, people are like, oh, well, if I don't like the wine of the day, what happens? But if you sell good wine...
We force it down your neck.
Yeah, exactly. And you drink it. but it's that confidence that people started to have from us, choosing good, you know, the right wines for the area and, you know, from good suppliers. So that's how we kind of all started, really.
It's interesting because, I mean, with my bar, I don't know if you know this. So I borrowed from a friend who has Gerald's bar in his two bars, one in Melbourne and one in San Sebastian.
Okay.
And he always used to have just three or four reds and three or four whites open at a time.
By the glass?
By the glass. Okay. And then, but it would change every day. So it's like, what have we got open today? And he's still, I haven't been home for a few years, but I love that concept. Because that way, everything is available by the glass. We just don't have everything open. It's just four reds and four whites.
Yeah.
And invariably, you know, whoever came in first on the day is like, right, choose whatever you want.
Oh.
And they're like, really? I'm like, absolutely. So they can have the cheapest, they can have the most. Didn't mind. There'll be a couple of things that we would have done which were not by the glass.
Yeah,
okay.
But the idea is that we would use that day. And if not, that day would be done by the next day, and that was it.
So every day, and you buy the glass, like the
four.
First customers can
so
choose
had eight.
Four.
And then there's always rosé open as well.
Yeah, rosé.
And in terms of waste, you don't have any waste? You're selling everything? Yeah,
none at all. It's great. Because,
makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, because you'd say, well, I've got this, and because they're open, you give them a taste, and then they're like, oh, okay, I'm not so scared now. This is cool.
I'll
drink that. And like, oh, I really like that. What else have you got open? Oh, and then you start to, and you're teaching them at the same time.
Yeah.
So I never had waste, and then, you know, at the end of the night, have a knockoff, have a drink, or you had a great customer, you share a bit more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
any fine wine, or it was just like more, well, as you say, it can be like cheap and expensive, but obviously when I say fine, I'm going to talk about like the plus £100.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had a few over 100. Not a lot. I mean, I think I topped out at 150. But not many. There's just a handful.
Yeah.
So there was like, I'd have a small selection. Mm.
Okay.
That there was sort of a separate fine. I'm having to think back now. It was a small list where people could just buy the bottle. So yeah, I did have, so they were not by the glass. But occasionally, if there's someone who's like, yep.
I love that concept.
They'll have a couple. And I think it's, people were like, you can't do that. Watch me.
Yeah. It's your bar.
No. I mean, and because I was there every day.
Yeah.
And
if you work in it, it's different.
And it just becomes, I don't know, people are so scared. And as you say, it's like, oh, what if I don't like it? We do something else.
Yeah.
Even now at Roe, I'm at a table. But I said, if you don't like the wine, I'll drink it. I'm happy, you know. It doesn't matter. We can celebrate the glass. It's fine. But, you know, people get so worried. Mm. And I think, you know, it's nice to be able to say, that's fine. You'll like it. Especially when you understand someone's palate.
Yeah. You used to have Coravin a bit for the by the glass, or it was just like
no Coravin.
Open the bottle. No. No Coravin.
Sorry, no Coravin.
It's fine. It's not the partner of the podcast. Of this one, so it's fine. On the previous podcast, we had Greg, the founder of
Coravin. Yeah, I met Greg. I do a bit of writing, so I wrote a piece about
so
the
cool.
So what I love about your position today, so a few things. When you were when you started in wine, did you ever think of becoming where you're at now? Because you created a position which is very unique, very tailored, of how you have passion in wine. And I feel like you're in your perfect kind of world that it feels
it was,
like that.
It was so carefully planned. Not I mean, it's been very much a sight and see, you know. 20 years ago, I thought I was going to become a scientist. I thought I was going to be doing work in environmental policy and dealing with bioremediation and a very different field.
Yeah.
And here I am, you know, and it wasn't until I went through a lot of, because I've been at university and I've studied and I should be doing what I've studied.
Mm.
And suddenly I'd fallen into wine going, hold on a moment, I've come to London and I'm staying here and I've fallen into this industry and I like it and I seem to be good at it. And I remember I had Matthew, because when I was doing all the PR with Bibendum, I got to know all the journos. And I had Max Allen was over from Australia, and I'll never forget it. I had Jukesy saying to Max, have you met Vix? You know, she's got a formidable palate. And I was sort of did that, what? What did you, oh, I had no idea. So even though, so I never studied. That's the other thing. I've never done, except for my MW.
Okay.
So sure. Go figure. But I had no idea that I had a natural palate. So it's always just been really instinctive for me. And so suddenly to hear that, I'm like, okay, maybe I'll just stay in the wine trade after all. You know, because I'm like, should I go and do medicine? Should I go and get a real job?
Mm-hmm.
Because I always fight thinking, this isn't really a job. It's not what I trained for, but I'm using everything I studied in many ways. I'm using the science, I'm using my right, you know, so I'm using it, but it just doesn't feel like a proper job.
But which is amazing in a way, because it means that you wake up and you're just like, I'm not going to a job, I'm going to this.
To what I love.
Yeah.
And I do love it. And it's always fun. No, yeah. It's not always fun. It's a drag sometimes. I like.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you people go, oh, it's so romantic. You know, you go to tastings all the time. You try judging for 2 weeks and tasting wine at 9:30 and going through about 100 wines a day.
Oh, God.
When your teeth are black by the end of it, or your teeth are hurt from all the acidity.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting. And then you've got a panel of people that you're manoeuvring and negotiating and managing who all have different palates, and you've got to be really diplomatic.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this, that's another skill set that.
And so you became a judge quite early.
Mm.
We spoke to, who was it? We had her, she spoke about, because she went into wine quite early and in the UK, and she said it was very hard at beginning because it was a men's world in a way.
Sure.
He was with Alex Price.
Yeah, with Alex. What's your
point of view
on that? Was it the same for you?
So I was at a wine dinner recently and there were three women and the rest were men.
Okay.
But I don't, it's weird because I don't notice the sexes, they're just people.
Mm.
But But I do look sometimes, you know, okay, it's weird that when it's a room full of women, then you go, hold on, it has a very different feel, and I don't know if it's always a good feel. This is going to be controversial, because I'm a strong believer that I think you need a combination. Yes, it is still male dominant, absolutely. So many of the marketing roles are women. All the PR, it's women. Women, 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 yeah, everywhere. Mm. And the men aren't really there. Reps can be both. You know, there's more and more women sommeliers, which is great to see. But I think there's also there's this weird thing that goes on where women should be supporting each other, but I don't think they do.
Actually, there's a few group of like women in hospitality and more actually. Yeah. It's very recent.
But I'm still not convinced, and maybe I'm just not cool enough. But I do think we start to get a little bit political. Just because of what sex you are, should you be a group?
Yeah,
you know, it's really more about being kind to each other and sharing your knowledge.
Yeah,
instead of going, you know, I've hired staff, I've worked with people. You know, you see some people who are so, they're insecure. And they go, oh, I hate this wine. I'm like, have you tried it? You know, it's sort of a, try it. It's okay. If you don't know about it, we don't mind. It's sort of that. It's easy to be really judgmental. Speaking as a judge.
That's true. That's true.
But yeah, I think there are more women, but it's tricky too.
I feel like there's a real evolution about this. Like, well, like Alex said in a previous podcast, where it was very like male dominated a few years ago, and now, as exactly as you said, more and more women are in hospitality, and they talk, they're like, you know, we're here, we're in hospitality, we're sommelier, we're chef, we are chef Doran, we are here.
Yeah.
This is changing, and this is great.
The classic. Mm. I think many a woman will go out, if you go out for dinner, and the sommelier comes and gives the wine list, who do they hand it to?
Yeah.
It's always to the men.
Always the men.
Every time.
That's true.
And I'm like, really?
I always, it's very true, and I always, when I'm with my girlfriends, I always tell her, you choose or you order all the time, because I realise that a lot. And when they come as well to who wants to try the wine, I always go, the boss.
I used to do the same sometimes.
I don't like the stereotype.
And I always feel like, why, you know, it can be like the opposite. Maybe my girlfriend is a sommelier and I'm working in fashion.
I mean, she's the one who ordered as well. So
it. Every row I've got guests and I'll say, right, who'd like to try the wine? So if I'm not sure who's ordered it, I will automatically say, would you like both try? Let's both try it. Do you think of it? Great. Exactly. It doesn't hurt to show that little bit of humility. Exactly. And I find that sort of stuffiness, I think that's probably my greatest pet peeve, which you haven't asked me, but I'm just offering it. I think it's that that arrogance that still dominates at times.
Yeah, completely.
I think that's the word, arrogance. Even like for the bill. Yes. I don't know, but if you're going to a restaurant,
give it to the man every time.
They're always giving to the man. Like, it's this kind of like weird attitude that people have.
Yeah, just pop it there where you're not quite sure there's that no man's land.
No, but even like, you know, for the wine, just pour two little tastes. We can both try.
When I work on the floor at Bermondsey Corner and I serve a beer and a wine, I always, you know, stop and say, who has the wine? Rather than going to the beer for you. You'd be surprised how many times it's like actually...
It goes the other way around. Yeah.
Like
the
classic of the burgers and the salad.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're going to give the salad to the lady.
So, obviously, you're a judge.
Yes.
Arthur, you're going to be a judge next week. I don't know I'm allowed to say it, but I think if you've got one recommendation for Arthur, who's going to be judge for the Trades Drinks next week.
Okay,
are you going there?
I am not.
Okay.
I will send you a ticket.
Okay. It's for small judges, not,
an important what
would be your recommendation? Advice. Yeah, for advice. As a judge.
Trust your instinct.
Don't smile.
Trust your instinct.
Okay.
It's really easy to be swayed, but also don't be... I think when you know your product, don't be arrogant, but trust your instinct. Mm-hmm. It's easy, but also, depending on how the judging works, so I normally work very collaboratively. So I was in South Africa couple of months ago doing another competition. I had the same panel for the full week. And I pretty much became an expert in Chenin Blanc coming out of South Africa. Nice. I tasted a lot of it. And there's three different styles.
Yeah.
But the thing is, everyone has a different palate. Everything is personal. As long as you can back up why you think it's what it is, as in what you think it is value-wise or quality-wise, stick with it. But don't shout someone down. You know, it's for me, it's always... That's just more than one piece of advice, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. Now, to be fair, that's one thing I will never do. But even like when we talk about it in the previous podcast, about the hospitality and restaurant in general, is we talk about the review. For me, like... when you experience with a wine or a restaurant, it's good, it's great to share. When it's bad, you can share if you want, but you have to make some manners.
You've got to explain why it's not good.
Exactly.
So you may not, and I think pet peeve number two, judging, and I've worked with so many judges, some of whom have MWs and who have tasted a lot, but it doesn't mean that everyone knows everything. And there'll be people that just don't have a skill set. You know, I know a lot about Rutherglen stickies, which we don't see very much over here, for example. Or there'll be, you know, cool Tasmania, whatever it is. Everyone has their strength. But then there are some wines that I'm just not a fan of. But I will happily, and I was in Stellenbosch, I was like, I am not a Pinotage fan. So I'm going to be judging these badly. You sort of put it out there.
Mm.
Saying I have a skewed view because I don't like the wine. So I'm going to judge it as best I can as a quality. Not do I like it or not. That's irrelevant. You start to look at how it is on the palate, the length, the breadth, what the acidity is doing, the balance. So if you can take your personal view out, I mean, when you like wine, it's even easy. It's really easy to judge. But at the same time, you've just got to remember and be honest with yourself. I'll get a flight of Pinotage, go,
Don't you lose a bit of maybe personality if you put like all your personal tastes away and you just focus exactly on the quality of the wine? You know what I mean? Or is it great for a judge?
Because these competitions I judge at, it's about quality, where it sits sort of on the world stage.
Yeah.
Does it sit at a gold medal level? Does it sit at this?
Yeah.
Does it have character? Most gold medal wines will have character. And you go, that's fantastic. It's something that you want to drink a bottle of. Probably order a case of it. It's like, this is brilliant.
Mm.
Whereas if it's just a wine, you go, it's fine.
Mm.
Would you take it to a party? I mean, it's still well made, but some of those don't have much personality. So I think I don't think you do, because you have to be rational about it. You've got to be a little bit scientific. Mm. You can't... I know what you're saying. I think it's you do have to put a bit of a science hat on, a little bit, ideally,
and being focused on the proper quality of the wine. It's like you're tasting this wine, it's nothing compared to like everything I tried before. It's only this wine right now.
Exactly. The trap is to go, but this is better than this wine, and when you start comparing, because you have to look at the wine on its own. It's hard to do. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. And you get tired, and that's where you have when you have a panel, and that's what I love about the International Wine Challenge, because it is we'll have five judges, everyone gets to talk about it. We go back and taste it again. If we're not happy, we all agree the final mark, and it goes. Then there's the co-chairs that will taste it again too. So they say it's probably the most considered competition in the world. Because it's tasted so many times.
Yeah.
But it's really discussed, because there are competitions where you taste it, everyone's like, right, there are four judges, three have given it a gold, one's given it an out, or it comes down to a silver.
Mm.
And for me, that you've got to be able to discuss it.
Yeah.
And that's where I think competitions are great, but there's also negative.
A lot of pressure now. Well, I'm saying that, but...
Not really, to be fair. No, it would be fun. It would be the first one, so it would be,
But yeah, I was thinking when very I said out. That. when I said that, I was like, "Yeah, shit, me myself as well. I'll be a judge as well, but not for drinks.
For coffee.
Well, it is a drink.
It is a drink.
And some sort of healthy, meant to be healthy food.
Coffee testing, like a competition of coffee, might be very interesting.
Yeah, but
because coffee is a bit like the wine, actually, based on a different world. Obviously. But you know, you get different aroma, you get different ground.
I'm a bit worried because I drink coffee, but decaf now. I can't drink caffeinated coffee now. So
you can spit.
Yeah, but it's also about the packaging, about how the company has grown their kind of background of it and sustainability. So I don't really know what I'm throwing myself into, but...
there's only one way to learn.
Exactly.
And that's by doing.
Exactly.
Don't be scared
and just, you know, it's... But I think it is that, you know, wine-wise, I may have... One year someone decided, you know, there's that thing of... You're at a tasting. Oh, you can't spit the wine out. It's a terrible. It's a waste. You can't be spitting wine out. No, you have to spit it out. Especially spirits. Oh my god.
Oh god.
You know, spirits, that's intense. I've never done that side.
But no, obviously. But even like for the testing, to be fair, I've been to a few of testing. It was last month or a few months ago. I don't remember. With some friends, they're not from the industry, and so obviously when you bring them to a testing. It's so funny because like, oh, why are you spitting? And you're like, well, you'll see after the 60th wine, you know what I mean?
But for them, it's an event, so for them, it's like...
Exactly, it's like, but it's free and it's good wine. Yeah, don't spit. I'm like, yeah, but like...
You have to.
You have to, like...
I mean, everyone
it's,
has
it's
to
not
do.
Sustainable if you stay like 3 hours in a tasting.
I mean, do you remember your first time you did a wine fair?
Wine fair can be different because you can go to a wine fair for fun.
Yeah, no, of course, but your wine tasting, the first one you've done, do you remember it? Because my first one, I was like, meh.
Well, you know.
I think, yeah, because I didn't want to spit. I was like, this is, you know, free. Like you said, it's free, it's good wine, it's a bit of shame to it. But you just learn by that and you're like, okay, next time I'll wear.
Yeah, when you're being carried out.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you remember the next day after the thing, when you're trying like 60 different wine and you never spit. But obviously, guys, if you can spit, just spit. And you're not wasting anything. You get the flavors at the end.
And you still absorb a bit of alcohol.
Yeah,
anyway.
And exactly. You always have a little bit of alcohol. So even if you spit your 60 wine, maybe you have drink like a little glass of wine.
Yeah, probably.
Kind of.
And I think on this note, we're past an hour.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah,
it's gone an hour and 5 minutes.
And 5 minutes. But there's a question we always like to ask at the end, because this podcast is all about giving the next generation a bit of a...
motivation. You
know, a bit of an image of what hospitality has. Yeah. And we always ask our guest if there was a, I don't know, 18, 20-year-old-ish...
Oh, you mean someone like me?
Yeah, exactly. Completely. Who wants to throw themselves into the wine industry?
Yeah.
What would you recommend to obviously not become like you because you're very unique. That's sure. But to have that path of self-built and especially going in that path that you kind of constructed yourself, really.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I have... Sounds like a pun. I've followed my nose. Boom tish. But it, for me, what I've always said to people, taste, and smell everything. You know, that thing about whatever you do in the wine trade, it really helps if you can taste wine and you can have some idea of good quality. So I say to everybody, you know, go to the market, go to the supermarket, wherever you buy your fruit, smell everything. I literally smell your jumper. You know, when it's wet, like what does a wet dog smell like? All those things, and build a database of smells. And if you're not sure where to start with one wine, so one varietal, and just do it across different countries or different regions. Mm-hmm. And so it's those small steps. So that's just sort of 101, just learning more about wine. As far as a career, oh my goodness, you know, follow your passion. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I had no idea I'd be where I am now. I'm still not quite sure where I am. I'm still growing up.
Yep.
I'm hoping I'll work out what my career is going to be.
I mean, you're 20 years old.
Exactly, right. But no, I mean, there's something not quite there with that. I think there's a time machine involved. But I think it is that learning what your skills are. And, you know, I'm really fortunate because I fell into it. I have a natural palate. You know, I'm one of the few people who started MW without any WSET qualifications.
Do you say MW?
Mm.
Your master of wine.
I never finished it.
Okay.
So I started. Yes,
I wanted to talk about it before because I heard the MW and I was like, oh, maybe it wasn't like MW, but okay.
Yeah. They let me in.
You want to tell us a bit more after the advice?
Sure.
Yeah.
Taste a lot. Taste widely. If there are tastings, go to tastings. Ask questions. You know, I think if you're based in London, you're incredibly lucky. If you're outside of London, get down to London because there are so many tastings here. And for the trade, you know, the people you can meet, the winemakers, the range of people that we have access to is extraordinary. And if there's someone that you really admire, talk to them.
Yeah.
And people come to me and I'm like, why are you talking to me? I get it. And I'll say, taste this, look at this, try that. And it's asking the questions. But also remembering you know, the path you've taken.
Yeah.
Don't take it for granted, because there are a lot of people out there now who suddenly post-COVID, they've all decided to enter the wine trade.
That's
who
true.
Are not in the wine trade, who are, you know, I don't think you've got to be built a certain way to be in this trade.
Yeah.
This is passion. This is not money.
It's
a lifestyle. It sounds like such a line, but it is. It's where you can travel. The places you go, my God, you know, the vineyards, the countryside, the people you meet is fantastic. And very few people have that opportunity.
Of course.
Yeah. But I think if there's someone you admire, ask if you can hang out with them, shadow them for a day, things
especially
like that. And I think my biggest problem is I've never asked for help. I've done it all myself, and I'm terrible at asking for help.
Yeah.
So upon reflection, the one thing I wish I'd done was ask for help. Earlier on.
Yeah. That's a good one.
That's a good advice. That's
Just to finish. Yep. So, Master of Wine student, tell us a bit more about your Master of Wine. When did you send your application?
I applied when I was living in Australia.
Okay.
So that was 2012.
Mm. Okay.
So, you know, I do a 7-year itch, so I was here for 7.
So when you come back to Australia.
I went back to Oz, set up my own importing business. So I was importing Spanish and French wines to Australia. All new to market, but existing wineries.
Okay.
And it was something I wanted to do for years, because I'm a nerdy scientist, and I really wanted to write the paper. That's what I really wanted. And I applied, was accepted, moved to London to do it. I didn't want to do the Australian program because I think for me the European program makes a lot more sense. When I had to submit my application, I had to find Zinfandel Blush. Do you think Australia? I mean, it was almost impossible to find that stuff. And thank
That's
God.
The thing. You have to provide all the wines for.
And I think, you know, certain people have greater access. I think it's a really interesting program. I'd love to do the thesis. For me, that's that's what drove me. I didn't finish it. Will I do it again? I don't know.
Any reason why you didn't finish it? Because of work? Because it's too much work?
I was trying to run a wine business in Australia and live in London.
And it was too cheap.
It doesn't really work.
And it's very expensive.
It is and it isn't. You know, the cost to sit the exams, it's not that much. Yes, it's thousands. It's not tens of thousands.
Yeah.
But you've got to get access to the wine. Mm-hmm. Now, some people have privilege and they can travel anywhere, especially if you're a writer. You can get to things so much more readily. And there's a definite style with the MW. And I'm not about to slag the MW off. But as a former academic, I like rigor. Mm-hmm. And I think there are things that could be done to make it a better program.
No, but funniest that you say that, because we spoke about it with Arnaud.
With Arnaud, we talked about
remember,
with Arnaud. Exactly, same.
He didn't finish
same
it.
Story.
He didn't, we're the cool kids, the ones that don't finish, the ones that start and
but
don't finish.
He had a very cool story because he followed the path.
Robert Parker?
Robert Parker, so he worked after with Robert Parker, which he.
Really?
Robert Parker obviously told him a different philosophy of
slightly different approach.
Yeah.
To another subject for another podcast.
Change again. Okay,
but I think what the MW gives you is, and when I was in the depth of it, oh my God, you know, you become so acute about wine. You pick things like bang, bang, bang all the time. It also destroys your love of wine for at least 6 months afterwards, because everything you taste, you're going, hold on a moment, there's oak, yep. Oh, that's definitely French. There's no American there, but I'm seeing a bit of this. And I think, I don't know, it's full male. Well, obviously it's full male because it's red. But, you know, you'd be going through and you'd ask these questions and you'd be justifying all the time, which is fun, but it's exhausting. And you really don't want to have to do that. So you drink beer for 6 months later.
Don't you think it's too much? And maybe that's why there's a lot of people thinking that wine is very elitist. I don't know if you saw the documentary Some. about like the two free students who are doing the Master of Wine. And it's like kind of crazy. They have a full room full of post-its with like, for example, give me three grapes from the north of Rhone Valley. Or give me three grapes from Victoria.
And yeah.
It's crazy. It's they're like living, drinking, eating, everything.
You become
wine
a grape
every day.
You literally, I mean, you almost, your skin gets red and yeah. No, I think it's at the time the knowledge you have is extraordinary. The depth. But you don't keep it. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like cramming, but not. But I think, you know, some of my great friends I made during the MW course.
Yeah.
Because it's that network. It's really special because not everyone gets into the program. It's not designed for everybody. It does cost a lot. It takes a lot of commitment. And you either need to have a really supportive, a supportive husband, because most women I know have got supportive husbands who help them get through it. That was really a sexist thing to say, but honestly, I know so few women, single women out there who have done this on their own.
There's actually,
definitely more men. Yeah. And they all have family units to support. Or they've got a bucket of money.
Yeah, that's true.
Or they've got a job that allows them to do all of that. Or they did it 20 years ago.
Yeah.
When I applied, or when I was accepted into the program, there were just over 300.
There's
about 440, 450 now.
Still, in the world, it's not that much.
I mean, it's super elitist, but the knowledge you need. But it's interesting. You know, I still think that as we, my God, it's 3 hours in and we're still talking. Because the wines that you're tasting, the more you know, the less you know. Mm. It makes it harder. Because if you've tasted really widely, and as long as you can justify what it is that you're tasting, you're fine.
Mm.
But it depends then on who is marking the papers and what they know. So there's sort of I would hope it's right, but I'm a terrible skeptic and I'm a complete cow at times.
No, but also the thing is like, what I like about the wine is like you will never know everything about wine. Will never know every wine. So that's why this kind of competition, I do like it. For example, the WCG is fun. It's great. Yeah. But we are on a way different scale because it's still, you know, learning about wine, but still fun. Even for the deep WCG, it's fine. But the Master of Wine is like giving your life to wine for 2-3 years.
If you can do it all in 3 years, that is the shortest time you can do it.
Yeah.
It's a huge, huge commitment.
Mm.
And it's sort of every weekend that you're tasting. And, you know, if you've got a good study group, I mean, it's fascinating, but you will never know everything. And if you think you do, you're mad.
Yeah.
You know, it's just no.
Yeah.
It's you know, every time, happen. You know, every trip, you meet more people, you learn more things. Even just the effect of, you know, wind patterns on particular parts of vineyards and what they do to the skins and how they have to then think about how they change their winemaking to factor in the extra wind from that season. Little things like that.
Mm.
There's always something new to learn. And there's another great variety. And then now we're getting into a whole lot of crosses.
Oh, yeah.
And, crossbreeds. Yeah. So that gets into my genetic side. But yeah, there's so much out there. And anyone who thinks they can, it's probably like a surgeon. You're never going to know everything.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the beauty of the industry.
You just got to keep trying and exploring.
Yeah.
And hope that one day you'll know it all.
The world is yours too, you know?
It's your grape.
It's your grape.
Yeah.
I think we're going to finish on that. The world is your grape.
Perfect. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Victor, for today.
You. Do you want to give your Instagram maybe?
So people can follow.
Yeah, you can follow me on Victoria's Wine Secrets.
There you
nice.
Go.
Like that?
Loads of secrets.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, there's always something a little bit crazy on
and
there.
And we're going to follow as well, of course.
Please do.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Thank you guys for listening and definitely follow Victoria. Plenty
Thank
of
you.
Stuff to say. maybe one day you'll have a glass of wine in the next bar. Who knows?
You never know.
I would
know.
Love that.
But come down to Road. I'm around somewhere.
I want your own bar because I want to be the first one coming so I can choose.
Exactly.
If I can do that,
Let's
I'm very
talk.
Happy.
Let's talk.
thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you, guys.
Take care.
Cheers.
Cheers.